She is pastor of worship at Wesley. She's arts for social healing here at Wesley. She's pastor at Homer United Methodist Church. My husband's in Homer, Alaska. We're talking about Homer, Minnesota. Yeah. She's a life partner to Pastor Robert Hicks, who spoke with us. And she's speaking on the necessity of forgiveness, especially yourself and God, in order to live a life of integrity and meaning. Thank you.
So, well, it's true. I just came downstairs from my office right before the service. I didn't have to travel far. We did live in Alaska for 9 years, and I've been to Homer.
All right.
It's a funky town.
It is a funky town.
Yeah. I am thrilled to be with you today. I often, as I said, my office is right upstairs, and so I'll walk by before our worship service, and I'll hear you all singing, and sometimes it sounds like you're having loud, rowdy dancing in here, so I've been really curious as to what you do, and I haven't seen any dancing yet, so a little disappointed. Oh, stick around. Okay. Thank you, Nick. I was told that this was about your fourth principle, which is, and please show me grace if I don't get it completely right, the free and responsible search for meaning and truth. Is that close? Yeah? Yeah? So I was thinking about what that would be, and then I started thinking, maybe instead of what we should do that is a free and responsible search for meaning and truth, maybe it's what might get in the way, what things might make it difficult for us to have a meaningful life, to relate to people in an honest way, to have a personhood of integrity when it comes to forgiveness. And there is so many layers of forgiveness, and so I'm going to start by saying this is not just the casual, someone cut you off in line, or someone stepped on your toe, and they say, oh, gee, sorry, and you say, no worries. That's not the kind of forgiveness. This kind of forgiveness comes out of specifically personal, unjust, and deep pain. The kind of pain that comes from betrayal and brutality. The kind of pain that usually comes out of relationship, where you placed your trust in someone that they hurt you in an intentional way, or it might feel that way. And that's important, that regardless of whether or not the person that hurt you intended to, you were hurt, and you can carry a lot that goes with that. And there's a process that you need to go through to get past your hurt. The first is to recognize it's a real hurt, not to brush it off. The second is to recognize there's a frustration and sometimes a hatred that comes with that, especially if the person shows no remorse, especially if it's someone that maybe you don't even know, someone that has just acted in a way through a corporation where you end up getting your livelihood turned upside down. Those are different. Those all take work, and they take intentionality of naming it and recognizing it and then letting it go, releasing the power it has over your life. Forgiveness isn't necessarily about inviting someone back into your life, especially someone who has hurt you. It doesn't mean making yourself available to be hurt over and over again. It doesn't give power to the person who hurt you. It releases the power of the hurt over you, and that's really important. But underneath all of those, there's another forgiveness that is really, really difficult. And that's forgiving yourself. I had a seminary professor that would like to say that one of the true marks of humanity, one of our biggest tendencies, is to compare my insides to your outsides. Everybody puts on their face, but we know our dark thoughts. We know the things we've done that we're ashamed of. We know the stuff that we would never want to come into the light of day. And sometimes those are things that we cannot forgive ourselves for. Often, it's because we hurt someone that cares about us and that we care about. And we hurt them for whatever expedient measure, whether it was embarrassing to tell them the truth, or inconvenient, or whatever it might be, but what we carry is also sometimes what we didn't do for someone when they asked for help and we were too busy, or we turned them down, or we didn't listen. Those are sometimes even the hardest to forgive. There is, as all of you are aware, this horrific earthquake catastrophe in Turkey and Syria. Every time I turn on the news, the numbers are larger. When I went to bed last night, the numbers of the dead found were 27,000 people. That's more than the people that live in the city of Winona. And that is just the beginning. But what struck me as I was thinking about coming and speaking with you all today is this image I saw. It is a man sitting on a piece of broken concrete about 6 inches high. And he's surrounded by the rubble of a building. And to his left, you can see just the side of a white mattress that has a bright pink blanket on it. And there's a little hand resting on the top of the mattress. And this man is just sitting there holding his hand. He's been there all day and all night. It's the hand of his 15-year-old daughter who did not survive. But he won't leave until they can get her body out. He won't let her be alone. And I saw that image, and it reminded me of a situation of a woman I know. And all I could imagine is that if he is anything like so many of us who are parents, there are two things that is happening in this man right now. One is he is thinking, why did I make it? And why didn't my child? Why didn't I do whatever I needed to do to make sure she was safe first? She was only 15. She had her whole life in front of her. Why? Why didn't I do something to have saved her? And then right on the heels of that is, and why did this happen to her? From my tradition, we would say, why did God do this? Why would God let something like this happen to an innocent child? It made me think of this little boy from North Idaho. Oh, he had curly, curly hair and bright blue eyes, and he had so much energy. Loved racing down the center aisle during church, and he loved flat trucks, which are fire trucks if you don't speak his language. He loved flat trucks. They were the bestest in the entire world. And when he had his third birthday, his grandfather had made him a big red flat truck. And it was bigger than him, and he could sit on it and ride it around. And his parents gave him a fire chief hat that he would put on his head and sit on his big red flat truck and ride all around. He was adorable. And his parents loved him deeply. Their first child, the first grandchild, and he had so much curiosity about the world. There was so much just energy bursting out from him. And as he got older, he still, he loved his flat trucks, even when he started calling them something else. And he remembered his birthday when he was 5, and his parents, they took him to the fire station where all the fire trucks were pulled out and were being washed, and he got to help wash the fire trucks. It was the best day ever. And even as he became a teenager, he would still talk about that being the very best birthday he'd ever had. And as a new birthday would approach, he would ask his parents, is this going to be better than that one? Are there fire trucks involved? Eventually, his passion for fire trucks faded, and instead it was replaced by discovering how to code, how to write computer programming, how to build firewalls, how to protect against viruses. He was passionate. He was passionate about it. He also was gay. And when he first told his parents, they weren't surprised. They said, We will love you no matter what. You are our child, and we are so proud of you and the person you are becoming. But this was North Idaho, and there wasn't a very accepting feeling in that community. And so there reached a point after he graduated from college and he had his computer science degree, where he turned to his parents and said, I don't think I can find happiness here. I've been offered a job in Atlanta, and I want to go. And of course, they said, absolutely go. We will support you. We'll miss you, of course. But you do what you need to do. So he took the job. He packed up. He moved all the way to Atlanta, the whole other side of the United States. And he would call. And he would talk, especially to his mom, every week, sometimes multiple times a week. Sometimes he had important things to say. A lot of times, especially when he first moved there, it was about getting settled into his apartment and about how his boss was cool. They were on a first-name basis and they hung out together outside of work. And then there was the time he got himself a kitten, a little orange and white kitten that liked to climb up his socks underneath his pant leg. They talked all the time, multiple times, about big things, about little things. They talked until one Monday morning, when the phone rang at an unusual time of the morning. You know that unusual time. It was probably 9 o'clock in Atlanta, but it was early in Idaho. And you know that feeling when the phone rings early in the morning. And the dad answered the phone, and they say, hey, your son didn't show up for work this morning. Did he go away for the weekend? Is maybe car trouble? Do you know anything? We haven't been able to reach him. No, we just talked to him 2 days ago. He wasn't going anywhere. They call his cell phone. They call his friend's cell phone. They call the landlord. They call the landline. They call everybody they can think of to see if anyone has seen their son. And no one has. And they call the police. And they're told that horrible thing that you understand intellectually, but no parent wants to hear. It hasn't been long enough. Your son hasn't been missing long enough for us to do anything. So they have to wait and wait and wait until finally enough time has passed and the police go to his apartment and then they get that phone call. I am so sorry. It seems your son took his life. These parents were at first just numb. It didn't seem real. And then it was the guilt. We talked to him all the time. He can tell us anything, yet we didn't know that he was in that kind of pain. We didn't see it. What is wrong? What kind of parents are we that we couldn't tell our son was hurting that badly? And then comes, how? How could this happen? How could God do this? How? And that became rage. When the funeral happened, they stood there, and the big red wooden fire truck was up on the table. And they stood there, husband and wife, his hand on the small of her back, as she spoke to the congregation, saying how much she appreciated how welcoming and loving they had been of her little boy as he grew up, that this was a place that he really cared about. He felt seen and valued, and how she wished he could have taken that feeling with him when he moved away. And the father said, my hope is that he heard us and he believed us when we said, we are so proud of the person you have become. But we don't know. months went by. And you could not recognize this woman if you passed her in the street. Her mouth had become a thin, straight line, and there were permanent wrinkles between her brows, and her shoulders were stumped forward, and she looked angry because she was. She couldn't get past what had happened, and she couldn't get past the fact that she somehow failed her son. A year went by. Another year went by. And then she was having a conversation with another parent. And they had had a grandchild, a miscarriage. So they were talking about the pain of losing a child, even a child that you hadn't yet known. And this other grandmother said, there's a book that helped me. It's written by Anne Weems. And she wrote, she's a Presbyterian poet laureate when she was alive. And this was a book of psalms, prayers, that she had written after her son was killed. It's one mother pouring out her anger and her rage and her guilt and the pain of losing a child. And she loaned the book to this mom. And she read it, and it's as if it gave her permission to just scream out at herself, at God, at the universe, at all of it. Scream out her pain and her anger over and over. Until one day, not like a bright light flashed over her head or anything like that, but one day when she woke up, she heard the birds. And she realized there was still beauty in the world. It took her a long time. But something happened over time where she realized that even though her son's life had been cut short, and even though she might have missed something that could have saved his life, she couldn't bring him back. But what she did still have was life. And rather than live a life of anger closed in on herself, she wanted to live a life to honor him, where she could find joy and beauty in each and every moment. She will never, ever get past that little voice in her head that sometimes whispers, but what if you had heard? What if you had done, or maybe you should have called one more time, or she'll never lose that voice. But she's able to shush it a little bit and say, but that is then, and I have been given this moment, and the best thing I can do now in this moment is to live as fully and honestly and generously and joyfully and lovingly as I possibly can. To have a truly free and responsible search for meaning and truth in life, sometimes it begins by forgiving yourself. In my tradition, I'd say amen. So, amen. I'm told people ask questions sometimes.